Hey guys, I am Kevin Dees, and you are listening to the Robo Juice Podcast. Brad Williams is the co-founder of WebDev Studios. He was a co-host on the Dradcast podcast and SitePoint podcast. He's the co-author of Professional WordPress and Professional WordPress plugin development. Brad has been developing websites for over 20 years, including the last 10 years. He has pushed his focus on open source technologies like WordPress and BuddyPress. Brad is a regular speaker at WordCamps across the country, and he has organized and continues to organize meetups for WordPress, including WordCamp Philly. Brad, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Kevin. I think some people might say I have a little problem with WordPress, but I think it's a good thing if you're passionate about something, right? So,
absolutely.
Yeah, excited to be on the show. I know I had you on my podcast. I actually looked it up. It's, believe it or not, it's 3 years ago that you were on the Dradcast podcast that I was doing at the time. So it does not feel like it was that long ago, but it was.
Yeah, time can move on you when you stay busy. So
that
lots to
fact.
Talk about, lots to get to catch up on here, which is excellent. Now, I know a little bit about your background. That's, you know, you have this long list of things that you've done that you continue to do. Where did all of this start for you? From what I understand, high school?
Yeah. So you mentioned I've been, you know, building sites over 20 years. And obviously, you know, if you do the math, we're talking about mid-90s. I really got into the internet early on. You know, one of my, you know, at my school, one of the first, you know, kids that had internet, dial-up, you know, 2400 BPS going into dialing into AOL. At the time, AOL was like available on a single floppy disk. So I think it was maybe version 2.0, but, you know, I got online and it was just magical, you know, at the time, just the idea of interacting with people all over the world. Chat rooms were obviously big back then. I don't know, other than chat rooms, like what else I did on AOL, but I'm sure I did other things. But that got my interest in the internet. I started to learn about websites and web pages, and I set up my first website. I was in high school. I think it was a sophomore. And I used AngelFire, which was like a free, you know, throw up some HTML pages type of service, kind of like GeoCities, if you're familiar.
From Yahoo, just, right? GeoCities, yeah, is Yahoo.
Yeah, I think it was. Yeah, I think it's shut down now or archived. But, you know, it was back in the day when you could just push stuff up. You didn't really think about domain names. I mean, people had them, but it wasn't as easy to get as they are these days. So I pushed up a little website, and then I'd go to school and like show it off to all my friends, like, hey, if we go to this really long, obscure address, you can see the website that I put up. And then we would update it. Like, I had different friends that would, you know, watch a basketball game and then do a little write up about the game with the scores, like a recap. And then I would type it in, you know, the next night into the website. Then we'd all be at school like, whoa, look at our cool website. So that, I mean, just getting that little taste of it sparked it all. Like, I've always had a passion for the internet ever since, and have always wanted to learn as much as possible about technology, specifically around the web. And I knew from that point on that I knew I'd be in computers, but from that point on, I knew it'd be, you know, more focused around the internet and the web. So
is there a specific moment, like a memory that you have of when you first heard about this thing called the internet?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think I knew anything about it until we bought a new computer, you know, like a family computer. And, you know, we did a bunch of research and ended up getting a Mac. And this is before they were cool, right? So this, you know, is a Performa 550. I think I remember the specs because I always kind of consult back to that computer as like my first kind of official computer. I had a Commodore 64, but I felt like that Mac was kind of the first one because it had a CD-ROM and it was like a 33 megahertz processor and a, you know, 100 megabyte hard drive. Like, it was top of the line. And it had, you know, internet capability. It came with that 2400 BPS modem. It came with like free AOL. And that's when, you know, we just plugged it in. We're like, well, let's check this out. We don't know what it was. And I distinctively remember the first time the modem made all that crazy noise, you know, the connecting and, you know, just that crazy be-doo-doo, and then it was like, welcome. And I'm like, that was pretty cool. Like, what is this thing I'm in now, you know? And then it was just a, I was always so curious about computers, I would just sit there and just click around and play with everything. And I was the same way on the internet. Like, I just wanted to click around and see everything, you know? So I think just kind of initially getting online and realizing that you're able to interact with people over the world was that moment for me. Like, this is cool. And then trying to explain that to my friends were like, what are you talking about? Because they had no idea either. So it was pretty wild. And back then it was kind of like the Wild West, you know, everybody was just doing whatever they wanted. There was no real rules or standards or anything. It was just crazy.
I remember at that time, there was this big debate. Should you make your HTML tags uppercase or lowercase?
Yeah.
Like, it was the big debate for the longest time. So this is before, like you said, any kind of standards. But you didn't stick around the Angel Fire forever. Obviously, you have this business and you're not building Angel Fire sites anymore.
Right.
When did you go from leisure in your spare time to taking this seriously, moving toward it in a career?
Right out of high school, I joined the Marine Corps. And I actually joined the Marine Corps to be a computer programmer, believe it or not. So I knew that I wasn't really passionate about school. You know, I kind of went through the motions and, you know, did okay, but I wasn't like a, you know, honor roll student or anything. I was always extremely interested in computer classes, obviously. I'd take any and every computer class I could get, but back in the 90s, there weren't a lot of them, you know. I actually took kind of a quick side story, but I took a computer art class, and you know, they propped it up as, we're going to get Photoshop, it's going to be amazing. And I'm like, yeah, that's awesome. And then the funding fell through, so it ended up being two semesters of Microsoft Paint because it was free and it was on all the computers. So I got really good at MS Paint, you know, for a year. But you know, that's how it was back then. There just wasn't funding for stuff like that. So I joined the Marines. And they, you know, went through boot camp, did all that fun stuff. And then I went to school to learn how to be a developer or programmer. And that's what really kind of took my knowledge to the next level. Because I'm, rather than just kind of static, flat HTML, I'm learning programming languages and concepts. I'm learning variables, you know, conditionals, arrays, multidimensional arrays, you know, case and switch statements. Like, I'm learning the core of like every programming language. And we did learn some specific languages, but I think what I got out the most was just that general understanding of programming. You know, and that's where it kind of really elevated me to that next level. So, I, you know, was a programmer in the Marines the whole time I was in. You know, started out with Lotus Domino type stuff, ended up moving into more of the Microsoft side of the house with classic ASP at the time and .NET.
Which was Microsoft's version of the internet programming language, right?
Yeah, exactly. Classic ASP is kind of the precursor to .NET, which is most people probably at least heard of by now. .NET's been around for, you know, 15 years now. Classic ASP was a great language. It had some similarities like PHP, but it was easy to use. It was easy to learn, and it was powerful. You could connect to databases and started building more, you know, database-powered web applications. So that's what really got me more serious about what I was doing. And then after that, I knew, like, this is what I want to do. So once I got out of the Marines, found a job, did that for a few years, just grew my knowledge, and then eventually started Web Dev Studios, going at it full time, coffee table business, no funding, just bootstrapped from day one, and just grew from, you know, two of us, two co-founders, and grew up to now we're over 30 people. So
were you, it's been a fun ride. Were you being strategically entrepreneurial in that you got a job and then you started your business? Did you have starting your business in mind from the beginning, or were you inspired at your workplace to say, hey, I can do this myself?
I always had it was always at the back of my mind as something I wanted to do. You know, that entrepreneurial kind of spirit, it runs in my family. A lot of my cousins and, you know, grandparents had their own businesses. So I've been around it a lot, just kind of running your own thing. So it was definitely the back of my mind when, the great thing, I went to work at a company called batteries.com. You can guess what we sold. Batteries. Super exciting. But, it was great because I learned, you know, websites and specifically e-commerce at scale. And I knew it was a great experience for me because I was learning not only the tech side of running a website like that, you know, especially a transactional website, but also, you know, every piece of that puzzle, you know, the call center, you know, I ran the whole website for the call center. I ran the whole software that powered the warehouse, you know, to pick the orders and ship the orders, and integrations with FedEx and UPS for shipping and scales. And I mean, I knew, you know, I ran it from top to bottom on the technology side. So I got a lot of experience there. And I, you know, and that's why when it came time and I decided to make the leap, I had gained a lot, so much more knowledge than just the development of websites. Like I learned how businesses run, you know, and I took that knowledge and experience and brought it with me when I started web dev, you know? So yeah, I think it was, I didn't have a set timeline, like, all right, in a couple of years or 5 years or 10 years, I'm going to start a company, but it was definitely, part of that strategy. I think in the back of my mind, I wanted to do it. I didn't know when it was going to happen, and getting out there and getting more experience was part of that plan, and it worked out well.
When did that transition take place? Was this, what was the thing that pushed you out the door? Was it the dot-com boom, or was it just your own kind of, I'm ready to do this on my own?
It was after that. So this was, I started at batteries.com in 2003, and then I left in 2008. It was actually good timing because I had made the decision to leave. At the time, I was living in Indiana. My business partner, Brian, was in New Jersey. We were in the Marines together. That's where we met. We were both developers. So he went off and did the same thing, got a job. And then we said, you know what, let's do this. So I packed up my whole life and moved out to New Jersey. Went from a nice, beautiful house that I owned to sleeping in his loft. Like, it was really a total life reset, you know. But it was good timing. I wasn't married. I didn't have any kids. Like, it was like, if I was going to do something like that, it was the time to do it, you know. And it was, you know, the best decision I made because it worked out really well. It was definitely scary at the time. Like, I'm putting everything I own into a U-Haul and leaving the state. But in the end it worked out well. So that was 2008. And it was funny because when I put my notice in, like, hey, I'm leaving, about 2 weeks later, they announced the company had been acquired. So I probably would have had a job after, but it was like the timing was kind of good because the company got acquired a few weeks before I left. I helped with that transition. And then I had some ongoing work as a contractor after I left. So it kind of also helped jumpstart the business a little bit as like the first client. So the timing actually worked out really well with that.
When you started your business, did you jump into WordPress right away? Today, WordPress, you know, is touted. It hovers around the 25-30% of the market share for all websites as far as built on, right? So 25% or plus are built on WordPress. When did you come into the WordPress thing? Obviously, if you're starting early, it wasn't 25% of the web. So there had to be a reason that you jumped on that outside of popularity of the system.
Yeah, I mean, when we first started, no, it wasn't WordPress. I had used WordPress a little bit prior to that. I have a blog I had set up. You know, I'd been writing about, you know, the working at batteries.com and the transition I was making, just kind of blogging about it. So I had some experience with it, but it wasn't like, this is what we're going to use. It was, you know, it was more like, we'll do anything, right? Like, when you start a company, it's like, you know, you kind of have to say, look, what's going to work here? Like, anything that comes in the door, you kind of want to try to support because it's potentially a client, it's money, it's revenue for a startup that's bootstrapped. That's everything. We quickly realized that open source was a nice niche, just open source in general, not a specific platform, but we focused our content and our strategy around open source platforms. So WordPress, Drupal, Magento, we did some Zencart, Joomla. Like, if it was open source, we would work on it. After a few years of that, we quickly realized that we weren't great at all these platforms. We were okay. Like, we could figure it out, you know, kind of fumble our way through things, but we weren't great. And it was hard to become great because we were working on five or six different platforms all the time. So that's when we really kind of had a discussion and decided, you know what, let's home our focus. Let's pick the platform that we want to work on and become the best at that platform. And that was WordPress. And we made that move in 2010 to where we went 100% WordPress. And that was a kind of a scary move too, because we were turning away clients that were coming to us with Drupal work or Magento work in favor of WordPress. And at the time, you know, you mentioned WordPress now is quarter of the internet, but at the time it wasn't. It was still very much a blogging platform or seen as a blogging platform. So we were really having to sell people on WordPress. Now people just you know, they want WordPress, they find us because of that. But at the time, that wasn't the case. So so we eventually did. And you know, for the last, you know, 7 years now, all we've worked on is WordPress 100%. It was, again, another great decision because it went from, you know, a less than 10% market share to almost 25, you know, over 25% of the internet now. So obviously, there's no shortage of WordPress work out there. So it's been great.
Exactly. I mean, you're talking about over, I don't know the exact number, but the, I mean, that's close to over 60 million websites.
It's yeah, it's a lot. It's, and sometimes it's tough to wrap your head around, you know, how large that is. And even that number, you know, it's, take it with a grain of salt, right? Because there's, you know, they can only track things that are public. So there's plenty of intranets powered by WordPress. There's plenty of probably local installs that are used for whatever. So, you know, that stuff isn't being tracked. And that's true for all platforms too, right? But it's just a staggering number. And to be honest, the web has never seen a dominant platform like this ever. You know, we've seen dominant technologies. You look at something like Flash. It had its time where it was everywhere, right? And that's, you know, Flash is a technology. So it's, you know, it's not like a full-blown platform that you roll out and it's like a CMS of sorts. It's a technology that you could build something on top of or with. Or WordPress is that platform that, you know, so the web's never quite seen someone or a platform this dominant. So it's been very interesting to see how that's come to be and where it's kind of headed, you know, going forward.
Why did you pick WordPress over all of these other systems? I mean, you named several. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you made the right choice, but why WordPress?
For us, it was, we enjoyed working on it from a developer standpoint. It's pretty easy to kind of dive into and make some pretty interesting websites without knowing 100% every little, you know, detail of how WordPress works. It's a very powerful platform. You can do a lot with it. And honestly, from the client perspective, it's very intuitive and has been for a long time. Like WordPress has always had a big focus on user experience and the user interface. And in comparison, you look at Drupal where, you know, Drupal always had a big focus on, you know, the overall development side of it and less on the user experience. So for years, Drupal's a great platform, don't get me wrong. I'm not going to trash talk Drupal, but for years, their focus was so much on the development side of it that they didn't have a good focus on the UI or the UX. So when you would log into a Drupal site or we would take a client through it, they were just lost. Like they couldn't wrap their head around content modules and you know, the 50 different settings pages and all that stuff. It was very hard for clients to work in Drupal. Now, the last couple versions of Drupal have made huge strides in that front. So it's much more intuitive nowadays than it was. But where WordPress always, you know, you could sit someone down in front of WordPress and say, you know, write a blog post. Don't show them anything. Just say, write a blog post. And more than likely, they will figure out how to do it. It's not that hard, you know. So for clients, it was just a good fit. And that makes our job easier when they're very comfortable with the you know, the system we're giving them. So that was a big factor.
The user experience is a big deal for you. You're obviously not yourself and Brian anymore. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when did you make that first hire for design? And
yeah, so that, I mean, the first hire was a designer because that was our obvious weak spot, you know, that design side of the house. So we took an interesting approach early on, again, being bootstrapped and really, you know, you never know early on, you know, whether you're going to have a full week of actual client work or not, right? So we couldn't just hire someone full time. Even part time was tricky because it was like, well, I can't guarantee you how much work we're going to have for you from week to week. So we actually started out with interns. We got set up with the local community college and said, hey, we're a new startup. We're building websites. We have a couple clients. You know, could we, you know, have some interns basically? And you know, we started getting interns and it worked well because they were learning and they needed the experience and we were, you know, building a company. So our first hire was actually an intern. His name was Chris. He came in, did great for us, and then we, you know, hired him part-time. And so he worked for us for a number of years, eventually became, you know, as we grew and you know, had more you know, financial stability, became a full-time employee. So, you know, it's a tough one because those first few hires are, you got to find the right people. And again, if you're not bootstrapped if you're not funded or have some, you know, nice amount of cash in the bank, It can be hard to jump right into full-time hires. So, you know, it's an interesting approach. Work with colleges. Obviously, you're going to get less experienced people, but they're going to be extremely eager. And that's what we found. Like, you know, Chris was great because he had that drive and that passion. He wanted to learn everything as well, and he was in school to learn. So, you know, he's bringing a lot of interesting ideas and stuff to the table for us that we didn't even hadn't thought about or didn't even know about, things he was learning, things he was researching. So, and we've grown over the years. You know, after, you know, the first year or so, we got to the point where we could, you know, bring on everyone full-time employees. Now we've grown. We have over 30 full-time employees. We're at 32 right now. 100% distributed, so we're all over the U.S. I think we're in 17 states, which works really well for the type of work that we do.
That's an interesting subject altogether, working with a completely remote team.
Yeah.
I want to keep us focused in here on this WordPress stuff because I think a lot of people are using the WordPress sites, and I just want to get practical. I want to bring some good value to people listening as far as maybe some myths about WordPress and some things that they can do to kind of capture a bigger picture about the ecosystem as a whole. And one of those things is this statement that you hear a lot: WordPress is popular, but it's also insecure. You're going to get your site hacked. Your information is going to be stolen. It's going to put you out of business. Don't use WordPress. It's not secure. Is that true?
No. So WordPress is definitely secure. And
so we have no worries, nothing to fear.
I would say there should always be some worry around security in general, because if you're lax about security, that's when something will happen, right? So I wouldn't say there's no worries, but I think it's the same worry that anyone that has a public website should have. I don't think it's specific to the fact you're on WordPress. So, you know, there's a couple things when people ask me, and we get this question a lot, like, is WordPress secure? You know, it's open source. We hear it's not secure. People hack it. What's going on there? So the one thing I point at is just look at the overall adoption of WordPress. You know, we talk about it's over 25% of the internet. It is running, and it's not, these aren't just, you know, blogs or bloggers. These are big media sites. These are companies like Microsoft, you know, Uber, Viacom. You know, these are massive companies, Disney, that are running WordPress. Now, companies of that size don't just take a platform and launch a website with it. They have their own internal processes, their own internal security audits that any system they use has to go through and has to pass before they're allowed to use it, for obvious reasons. Microsoft doesn't want to launch a site on WordPress only to have it hacked. And you can guarantee that Microsoft is a huge target for hackers, just like Disney is a huge target. They're big names.
And they're using WordPress.
And they're all using WordPress. And we work with Microsoft, we have for years, and I know for a fact that WordPress has gone through a vigorous internal security audit with Microsoft. This is not part of the open source community. This is Microsoft doing their own independent audit of WordPress and passing. So that's one thing I like to point out. It would not be this popular if it was insecure, you know, and especially on the enterprise side of the house. A lot of what you hear when you hear WordPress is secure, if you actually dig into where that's coming from, a lot of it's around authentication. And I'll give you a good example. It happened a few years ago. LinkedIn had a big hack. You know, tens of millions, maybe hundreds of millions of user accounts were leaked. You know, emails, passwords, you know, pretty sensitive data. What happened after that is all of a sudden, WordPress sites started to get compromised. And it wasn't just WordPress sites, but it got kind of the highlight of it. So all these WordPress sites started getting compromised. And basically what was done is the hackers got access to the LinkedIn data, and they wrote some very basic bots that said, hey, you know, this guy's email is brad@mywebsite.com. Let's go to mywebsite.com and see if we can find the login screen. Oh, it's WordPress. Let's go to WP Admin. Let's put in his email, and let's put in the same password he uses for LinkedIn. And guess what? It was logging them right in because they use the same username or same email and same password on a lot of different sites, including their own WordPress site. So all these sites that were, you know, quote unquote, getting hacked were actually just somebody logging in as the administrator on that website. And then, yeah, once you're in as administrator, you have full control, right? You can delete content, you can upload images, whatever. So that is what happened a few years ago. And all these headlines were about WordPress being insecure, and it actually had nothing to do with WordPress core. It was a user authentication issue. So when I talk about security, One, I try to eliminate that idea that WordPress is insecure, but I like to talk about how to lock down things like user authentication. You know, SSL is an important one. You know, everyone sees that HTTPS when they're buying stuff online, right? We kind of know that. We've known that for years. If you're putting a credit card in a website, you should have that SSL certificate. It should be green. It should look good. But that's true for any site where you're passing sensitive data. So any site you're logging into should have HTTPS. And that basically just encrypts the data that's being transmitted. So if you're at a coffee shop at, Starbucks or whatever, and you're logging into your website, if you're not on HTTPS, someone could potentially sniff out that data that you're passing because you're sending your username and password in clear text.
The browsers are making a big push on this too. Google Chrome is now basically saying in their web browser, if you're not using HTTPS, even if you have no login, or if you're just some mom and pop shop, right, where it's probably not like the end of the world if you don't have HTTPS, Google Chrome is saying, hey, you have to have this now. Why is this happening?
Yeah, I mean, mainly because of that, because it is an extremely easy, low cost or really free at this point, option for websites to make sure all data being transmitted is encrypted. Google is making a huge push because what they've done is they've come out and said that they're going to start ranking, HTTPS sites higher in search engines. So as soon as you start giving a search engine boost to something, people get real serious about it, right? So at the very least, even if for no other reason, do it because you'll probably rank higher in search engines. But it's great to see because it is that important. There's a number of ways to do it. If you're not sure, just reach out to your host and say, hey, I want to set up SSL on my website. I want HTTPS across the board. How can I do it? WordPress and almost every platform out there makes it super easy to do. So it's a requirement. The other one is I like to recommend is two-factor authentication for login.
What's two-factor authentication?
Yeah, if you're not familiar with two-factor authentication, it's basically having two different ways of proving who you are, right? So the easiest example that most people are familiar with is an ATM. To pull money out of an ATM, you need an ATM card and you need your PIN number, right? If you don't have both, you can't do it. So two-factor authentication for websites, very similar. Generally, it's done with logging in with your normal username and password, and then it will ask you to authenticate with, usually it's like an app on your phone, right? So you go to your phone, you pull up something like Google Authenticator, it gives you a unique six-digit number. You type it in on the website, it authenticates. So basically, the only way I can log into a website is if I know my username and password and I have my phone. So the idea that someone has compromised and stolen my user account and has also stolen my phone and can unlock my phone and can get to that second factor for authentication is extremely unlikely, right? So I enable two-factor authentication anywhere I can. I have it enabled for Facebook, for example. A lot of people don't realize that. I have it. If I log in on Facebook on a new browser, it's going to say, pull up the app on your phone and give me that unique number because we want to verify you are who you say you are. So that's another one that can really help on the security side. And that LinkedIn example I gave, if they had two-factor authentication running, the hacker or the bots never would have been able to log in.
Talk to me about, because I have to have my phone to do this two-factor authentication. Mm-hmm. There's got to be a deficit here of, If LinkedIn makes two-factor authentication required, maybe somebody has a website, like a blog, and people subscribe, they have to log in for a membership account. If you force two-factor authentication, that would naturally reduce the number of people who want to log in. Mm-hmm. Most of the time we have our phones on us. How do you overcome that? Or do you make two-factor authentication required? What's the scenario when that's appropriate?
I mean, I think a lot of sites, if they have two-factor authentication as an option, it is just that. It's an option. It's not forced. So something like LinkedIn or Facebook, I don't know. Honestly, I don't know if LinkedIn has it. I would imagine they do, but I know for a fact Facebook does because I have it set up. You have to enable it, and you have to say, yes, I want to. I want two-factor authentication. There's a couple things you do to confirm that. I don't think, while it is good, I don't think it should, sites like that, I don't think it should be a forced option. Because, yeah, you're going to, someone like my dad doing two-factor authentication, probably not going to work real well. He can get into Facebook and he understands it. But when you start getting a little too complicated with things like that, it might not work. But You know, there are some instances where you might want to force it. And an example is like with Slack. A lot of companies use Slack now. Well, you can
what's
have
Slack?
Slack is basically chat rooms, you know, private chat rooms for a lot of companies like ours, since we're remote, use them for internal communication for projects.
Need those conversations to be secure because you're talking about your clients.
It's sensitive information. It can be. Yeah. So you can actually have like a global policy that says you have to, you know, use two-factor authentication because it's like a company thing, right? It's a company policy. I think Google Apps, you can force that for like if you're using that for your company email or something, or Google Drive, you can force two-factor authentication. So that makes sense from a company perspective. But I think things like social networking, it should be an option because at the end of the day, there are going to be many, many users that just aren't technically savvy enough to do that, you know. So this is more about enabling it for yourself where it makes sense and where you have ultra-sensitive information. Bank accounts, I do it for social networks because I always get emails saying people are trying to log in as me, so I locked it down, you know, as much as I could. You know, all my hosting company, like, you know, my login, like WP Engine, for example, it's a hosting company. When I log in, it's two-factor authentication because I have access to a bunch of client, you know, accounts on there, you know, just anywhere there's real sensitive data. It's a good idea.
You had mentioned bot attacks. What's a bot attack?
Hackers, generally speaking, when they're trying to compromise websites, it's not, you know, like you see in the movie, some guy with his hoodie pulled up wearing sunglasses in a dark room, you know, plugging away. It's generally going to be a bot. So they're going to create a bot, you know, and basically what it's going to do is scour the internet. You know, a computer can do this way faster than a human, right? So the bot's going to scour the internet and look for sites to compromise.
Like a hound on a hunt using his nose, sniffing
basically
around.
Basically, yeah. Think about it like how search engines go out there and index the whole internet. Well, this is kind of the same thing. It's not really indexing, but it's trying to find websites it wants to compromise. So it's going to check things. When it hits your website, it's going to check like, hey, do I know what platform this website's on? WordPress. Great. Now I know what I want to try to target. Do I know what version it's on? Great. It's two versions old. Now I know what I can go after. So
they can figure that stuff out just by sniffing.
Generally speaking, yes, because there's ways to kind of test what version WordPress is. Sometimes there's a tag in the actual source code that says, but there's ways to do it just by testing different things, by looking for different things, because WordPress is open source. So the history of the code base is online. So you can see, oh, well, this file was introduced in this version. So if that file exists, you know, it's that version or newer, you know, so there's things they can look at like that. And then, you know, if it's WordPress, they know where to get to the login screen. You know, so you get to login screen. Maybe it runs a dictionary attack where it's just going through literally, you know, username admin and every word in the dictionary for a password, trying to break in with a simple password, you know. It's trying to do things, and it can do it in such an automated fashion that it's going through thousands of websites, you know, an hour or maybe faster, who knows, trying to find this stuff. And when it finds one that's vulnerable, it's going to go after it. So another obvious important tip is to make sure your software is always up to date. When there's a new version of WordPress, test it out and get it rolled out as quickly as you can. Just like you update your computer when a new update comes out, just like you update your phone, you know, you need to update the software that's powering your website. And again, 99.9% of the time, if WordPress is actually compromised from a code standpoint, it is because they are running an outdated version of WordPress and they have not updated. So definitely keep WordPress up to date. If you need help with that, there's tons of companies. We have one called Maintain where you pay a monthly fee and do it for you. You know, keep it up to date. We'll fix things if they break, take backups, all that good stuff. So I know it can be scary for some people to click the update button because something might break. If you're not comfortable with it, you know, work with a company or some people that you trust that can help you with that.
I've heard some really good stuff here from you. HTTPS, encrypt what you're talking about over the internet. You know, authentication, make sure your passwords are strong, have backups. All of those are really sound, real security solutions to a factor authentication. What you just mentioned, the bot sniffing things out, you can remove those tags and things from WordPress that kind of make it obvious that, hey, I'm WordPress. But what you're talking about there is different from what we just talked about. Again, the HTTPS and the better passwords. What we're talking about there is kind of this idea of, if you remove, say, those tags and you change certain things about WordPress, it becomes more obscure. So there's this idea of you know, security through being obscure, changing the default settings that people, you know, so bots don't go find the default when they look for it because they know it's there. So trying to keep people from assuming what's there is security through obscurity in that way a big deal? Where do you put your attention here? Should you really just kind of ignore that sort of thing and just focus on this real security stuff like policies for two-factor authentication? What's your position on that?
Yeah,
what's the recommendation?
It's a good question. You know, and me personally, I don't worry that much about things like that because...
So if somebody has a tag in their WordPress site that says, I'm WordPress, I'm this version, obviously you can remove that real easy, but you would say, don't worry about that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, you know, does it hurt to remove it? No. Does it help you to remove it? Probably not. You know, like I said, they're not, you know, will they look for that? Maybe. But there's ways to determine that version regardless, right? So it's exactly like you said, security through obscurity. So you're basically maybe hiding things. There's the notion of, you know, changing the login page, right? So it's not, you know, slash WP admin or something, like hiding it under a different, you know, quote unquote subdirectory, like a fake directory of some sort. But again, at the end of the day, there's ways to get around that. So I think the idea of it is don't assume you're making these little changes and that you're 100% safe because of it, because it is obscurity, right? So I think that's why a lot of people say don't focus on that type of stuff, because you don't want that false sense of security. Like, oh, I hit the generator tag, I'm good to go. If I don't update my site with the new version, it's okay because that generator tag that told me the version's gone. That's what we want to avoid, because you still need to update. You know what I mean? So, and there's some plugins out there. iThemes has a great security plugin that will automatically do some of that stuff. So if it is something you want to do, you know, use one of their plugins. It'll hide like the generator tag. It will make sure that anything that should be kind of suppressed is, it'll check, you know, local permissions at the server level to make sure they're not too open, you know, so they're not bad plugins and they can definitely help give you a little more insight, and a little more, you know, warm fuzzies that your website's secure. So
servers, we've talked a lot about the WordPress kind of platform, the software. That's one level of, you know, keeping that up to date. That's one level of security. But you also have this other level kind of underneath that, and it's where WordPress lives on the server. How do you protect your server? What are the right moves there for companies? Should they manage their own, or should they go with managed hosting? You mentioned WP Engine, for example. I think there's also, is it Pagely?
Yeah, I mean, my kind of rule of thumb on that is if you don't know what you're doing, like if you're not a sysadmin, and servers are not your, you know, your skill set, go with a managed host. And I like managed WordPress hosts like WP Engine, like Pagely, because all they do is host WordPress sites. So their entire server stack is set up in a way that it to make WordPress as performant and secure as possible. They don't have to worry about having a server stack that supports every possible application. You know, Drupal, WordPress, whatever you want to install. Like, all they have to worry about is how do we make WordPress as performant and secure as possible.
So you're looking for not managed hosting, but you're looking for managed WordPress hosting.
Yeah, that's my recommendation, because at the end of the day, you're going to get that. The managed part means they're going to manage the server for you. You don't have to worry about applying updates at the server level. You know, if the server crashes, you know, they're going to fix it. That's the managed portion of it. If you go unmanaged, maybe something like Amazon, you know, AWS, that's all on you. You have to run the server. If it crashes, you have to get on there and fix it. If there's an update, you have to apply the update, make sure nothing breaks. Like, unless you're an expert at that, leave it to the experts. So I like managed WordPress hosts. They know WordPress. You know, maybe some of your listeners have had an issue where they're like, hey, my website's broke. They talk to the host, and the host is like, yeah, it's definitely WordPress's fault. You know, they just immediately blame WordPress, and maybe because they don't know, maybe because that's an easy excuse. But when you work with people like Pagely and WP Engine, they understand how WordPress works. They understand how plugins work and themes work, and so they're going to help you, you know, figure out whatever the issue is, because that's all they do is WordPress. So that's why I really like those companies. They're good companies. They have, you know, great setup, great software, great teams. So I always highly recommend WP Engine and Pagely. We recommend them to our clients as well. We have a number of clients on them, and you know, I just think they're solid. They also have that big focus on security, and this is something I say too. Even if you're not on one of those hosts, and maybe you're looking for a host, maybe you have a host that you like, talk to them about how they handle security. Like, what is their actual approach to security? Most every host that's worth, you know, worth anything has a whole section on the website dedicated to security, and they talk about what they do to make sure that your website's as secure as possible from the server level. And that's important. If they're not talking about it, I would be worried. And so if you have questions, reach out to your host and talk to them and say, hey, what is your security approach? What is your security plan? Do you protect against hackers and bots and anything like that? What if my site gets hacked? Can you help me fix it? You know, these are good questions to ask. I know WP Engine and Pagely have those sections. A lot of hosts do, like GoDaddy and Liquid Web and some of the others. So if they're not talking about security, that's probably a red flag. You might want to look somewhere else.
You get a good host, you get hacked anyways. How important are backups?
Backups are the most important thing in life, I think. I mean, just, you know, backups for your website, backups for your pictures, backup upon backups. I've actually been my backup plan. But so how often is a great question, and that kind of depends on how active you are, right? So there's two kind of approaches, two general approaches to backing up your website, specifically around WordPress. One is the full thing. You back up the database, and you back up all the files, you back up all the media, everything. It's literally a snapshot of your website. It's a larger backup, usually takes longer because it's backing up all those images you've uploaded, so larger websites can take longer. The other approach is just to back up your database, and the database is where it stores all your content, or your settings, all that. It's in the database. So generally, I like to do a full site backup once a week. That's everything, once a week, right? I like to do at least a nightly backup of just the database. The database is going to be a much smaller backup. There's no images. There's no source files. It's just your content, your settings. Generally, got to be smaller. So it's a quicker backup. Take one a week. Now, if you have a very active site, if you're publishing multiple posts a day and you're getting hundreds and thousands of comments a day, maybe you want to do it, you know, 3-4 times a day, just for the database. But I think at least once a night's great, and then for a full site backup, once a week. I use a tool, a great plugin called Backup Buddy by iThemes. It's a plugin you install. It will perform both types of backups for you on a schedule. You can set whatever schedule you want, and then it will actually take those backups, and you can put them in different services, maybe Dropbox, maybe SFTP to another server. Maybe it emails it to you. Obviously, you want to make sure however you're sending that's secure. So it'll take that off your server. Imagine the server blows up, right? You don't want all your backups on the server because you'll lose those. You need to get them somewhere else. So it's a nice automated approach to backing up, and it's a nice plugin.
How many locations should you put your backups? One other location, or should you have it in your email, on the cloud, on your server? You
know, I mean, redundancy doesn't hurt, right? So I like to have backups in at least two locations, and that's for my website stuff and for my local stuff, like my pictures. You know, just it doesn't hurt to be redundant. And maybe you're not sending every backup to two locations. Maybe just once a month, you take that snapshot and offload it to a different location. So at the very least, you have a monthly snapshot somewhere else. But it certainly does not hurt to be redundant with your backups.
Should you encrypt your backups?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, just imagine if whatever data is within your website, how important is that data? How sensitive is that data? Maybe your website is a public blog and there's really nothing sensitive about it because it's all public. It's still good to encrypt because it's always a good approach. Think about it. You do still have your username, password, you know, within the database. It is encrypted, but, you know, it's certainly it's better not to get that released. So, yeah, I mean, I think encryption is, you know, for anything is definitely a good idea.
Where's the first place you should put your backup?
I like to offload it generally either to another server. If you have, another server you could put it on that's secure. You could use something like Dropbox. A lot of people have Dropbox these days, and I think the free account of Dropbox, what do you get, like a gig or something, or 10 gigs for free? I mean, it's a decent amount of space for free. And then maybe $100 a year, you get 100 gigs or something. So Dropbox is another nice one. And it uses a secure connection, you know, to pass that file. So those are some good spots. There's other services. I mean, you could use something like Amazon S3, I think, is an option too, if you just want to dump it on Amazon. It's another good secure one. It's a little more technical, I think. So if you're not as tech savvy, that might be a little trickier, but S3 is a good option too. The big thing is to make sure it's secure, right? You want to pass that file in a secure method. That's why email is probably not the best place for it, right? Because you can't guarantee the email is going to be secure. So,
for e-commerce transactions, records, you have to be PCI compliant. You have to have this stuff safe and secure. How do you handle backups in an e-commerce situation where you really need every single transaction backed up? Do you back it up, or do you distribute the database and kind of a live feed and hope that that doesn't go down?
You could do that. I mean, yeah, having, you know, kind of mirrored databases, one essentially being a backup, that's just literally copying everything that's happening in the production database. So it's a mirror. That way, if the production database gets corrupt or goes down, you can literally flip them. That's generally a good option for something like that. There are real-time backup services. VaultPress is one. That's it's a service ran by Automattic. It does not back up your files, but it is a continuous backup of your database. So as changes are being made in real time, it's backing them up, right? So if someone adds a comment or a new revision is made or someone uploads an image, it is constantly just grabbing everything new and backing it up. So that would be like another ongoing transactional backup. So like as orders are coming in or whatever, it's just backing them up immediately. And then you could easily kind of restore or download a backup file. So that might be a good option. I'd say either VaultPress or like that mirrored database approach, which if you don't know, your host can probably set that up for you. But that's going to obviously be on a larger plan, more like a dedicated server approach.
We haven't talked about plugins. You mentioned at the beginning, WordPress is secure out of the box. Microsoft's testing this stuff, but Microsoft's not testing every plugin that exists in the WordPress ecosystem.
Right.
How do you pick the right plugins so you stay safe? Do you use plugins?
Yeah.
Should you hire developers? How do you get the right developers? So first, plugins. How do you get that secure?
Yeah, I mean, great question. So there's over 50,000 plugins on WordPress.org. Those are all free available plugins. There are probably just as many, if not more, outside of WordPress.org, right? So my recommendation is, one, only use the plugin if you really need to use the plugin. A lot of these plugins do, you know, maybe you want one small component of it and that does 100 other things. Well, that's a bunch of bloat that you don't need, right? So find a plugin that does that one thing really well. I like the fact that WordPress.org now has reviews and ratings, so you can actually go on there. If you're not familiar with the plugin, couple things I would look at. One is look at the reviews, see what people are saying about it. Is it actively developed? Are there bugs? Is it working well? Are they the developers, you know, responsive to support requests? And also look at the number of downloads and active installs, because that's very telling. You know, if you look at a plugin like, here's an example, Contact Form 7, it has over 3 million active installations. And it tells you this right on WordPress.org. So over 3 million sites are running this thing. It's active, right? That gives me a lot of confidence. You know, 3 million people are running this thing. Who knows, you know, it's been downloaded even more than that, obviously. Yeah, it's been downloaded 57 million times. So the ratings, it's 4.5 stars out of 5. So this is, I don't have to look into it much more than that. I know this plugin's solid, right? It's a good option. Now, if you go to a plugin and there's, you know, 10 downloads and 2 active installs, it doesn't mean the plugin's bad, but it hasn't gone through the paces, right? So I would definitely be a little bit cautious and try to find one that's more supported. But it is something you always have to be aware of, because the plugins are just adding pieces of code to your website. And if those pieces of code aren't secure, that's another way people can get into your website. So stick with the ones that are, you know, actively developed, that are highly supported and highly used, and you'll be okay.
Should you use a lot of plugins, or, you know, obviously the developer's making some of these choices. So when a company's saying, hey, I want to work with company XYZ, you know, maybe it's Web Dev Studios or RoboJuice or whoever it is, what do they need to be looking for plugin wise? Like, if the developer is using 20 plugins, is that a red flag to security?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, the more plugins, the more opportunities there are for something to happen. You know, exploit or backdoor or something. I try to, you know, our stance is only use a plugin if it's necessary, right? We try to keep it minimal. Like, if you can, honestly, a good goal is like less than 10 plugins. And there are plugins out there that are great, that do some amazing stuff. You know, Yoast SEO is kind of a staple. That is a solid plugin that there's no reason to reinvent the wheel, build it over. Like, that plugin does some great SEO stuff. These, you know, there's some great contact form plugins. Gravity Forms is one that we love. There's no reason to rebuild how, you know, a form building plugin. But then there's other items like sharing links. You know, everybody loves, you know, Twitter and Facebook sharing links, where those are, you don't really need a plugin for that. They're not that, you know, it's not that hard to integrate those. It's like a couple lines of code and you're done, right? So anytime we can not use a plugin, we try to, right? Because again, it's less maintenance, it's less upkeep, it's less concern about, you know, what might come in that plugin down the road. So use them where they make sense, but don't use them just to use them, you know, because ultimately the more plugins you have, the more code you have on your website, the more maintenance it's going to require to keep those plugins up to date, the more likely something could happen. So try to keep it minimal, use them where it makes sense. And you know, just be smart about it.
When it comes to coders, programmers, what do companies need to look for when they're selecting that team for security?
Similar to like the hosting, you know, discussion we had, talk to them about security. You know, ask them like, hey, how do we know this website's going to be secure when you're done? What kind of security, you know, recommendations do you have for us? Because, you know, part of our conversation when clients come in the door is around security. It's something we always want to talk about, whether they bring it up or not. And we bring a lot of these ideas to the table. We're like, you should absolutely be on SSL. Let's do some two-factor authentication. Maybe have a force a strong password policy, you know, things like that. So
you're looking for coders who are going to bring this stuff up themselves.
Yeah, bring it up. Or if they don't, you bring it up and say, hey, what is your approach to security? Like when you're writing code for the website, how do you know it's secure? How do you know it's you know, as hack proof as possible? You know, we follow the WordPress coding standards. We know the WordPress has a lot of built-in, you know, functionality to harden security, you know, things to prevent, you know, SQL injection and whatever other, you know, method, XSS or CSERF or whatever. There's all these different functions and functionality and APIs built into WordPress to eliminate that, right? And we know that stuff. So we can talk very specifically about how we do that, why we do it, why things maybe make sense or don't make sense to a client. So it's part of the conversation that we always have. So I would just say if the developer you're interviewing or talking to or agency doesn't bring it up, you should. And just say, what's the approach? I want to make sure, obviously, our site is secure. What do you do above and beyond just, you know, the default WordPress to make sure that's true?
Outside of just having a conversation, what's kind of the plan that people need to be making when it comes to security today? If let's say they're starting from ground zero.
I think we mentioned a lot of the big ones for me. You know, obviously SSL, two-factor authentication is a big one. I mentioned a force a strong password policy. There's some great plugins that won't allow your users to use the password of password, right? It has to be strong. WordPress has actually made some good strides in this lately. You can auto-generate a strong password right in WordPress for yourself. So, you know, force a strong password. Maybe limit login attempts. You know, there's a great plugin for that. So if someone tries to log in 3 or 4 times and it fails, it locks them out for a period of time. You know, that would, you know, fight something like that dictionary attack I mentioned earlier. If it keeps failing to log in, then something's up, right? Like maybe they shouldn't be logging in. You know, I think those are some really good approaches. And obviously, like I said, making sure you're working with a solid host, because at the end of the day, you can have WordPress locked down as much as possible. But if your host doesn't have the server locked down or doesn't know what they're doing, you're never going to be protected. You're going to be open to, you know, vulnerabilities. So making sure you work with a solid host that understands security and what they need to be doing on the server level to keep your site safe.
Excellent. Well, Brad, I feel like this has been a great discussion. You're definitely up to speed when it comes to security, so I wanted to talk to you. You've given talks on WordPress security before. I knew that you were the person I wanted to talk to about this, so thank you so much for being on the show. Anything you want to leave people with?
Yeah, definitely. Thanks for having me. It's been a lot of fun. I think, you know, don't ever get comfortable. And this is just security and across the board, right? Not just for websites, like, you know, for your phone, for your computer, for your home, like never get complacent, I guess is what I'm trying to say. Like, you know, you always want to be thinking about it. You always want to, you know, make sure it's in your mind and in the conversation as you're doing things. And that way, more likely than not, you'll have a very safe and secure website. And you know, if something does happen, you know, you'll have those backups, you know, so that's kind of the safety net, right? Is to make sure you have solid backups and a backup strategy. So, you know, God forbid the worst happens and you do get compromised, you can just restore from a backup and away you go. So, it's important. I'm glad we're talking about it. I think, you know, there's some great presentation out there too. If people want to learn more, for WordPress specifically, I'd go to wordpress.tv, and you can just search security. There's a ton of great presentations out there from, you know, basic end user all the way to more advanced development security. Some really good stuff there. So if you want to learn more about it, but definitely thanks for having me on, Kevin. It's been a lot of fun.
Absolutely. It's been excellent. Hey guys, thank you so much for listening to the show. If you felt like you just got a lot of value, if you felt like you had any worry or any stress about the web before listening to this episode, and now it's gone, we would love to see a 5-star review from you on iTunes. We would really appreciate that. We would be super thankful. At RoboJuice, we make it our goal to come alongside you and give you the direction that you need by helping you establish a plan so you can be successful on the web. So that goes far beyond just doing a social media campaign or building a website. We want to help you establish a solid plan that's not just going to make you successful today, but also further down the line in the future. So if you're interested in creating a plan that's going to help map you to success, whatever your vision or your mission is for your business, we want to help you get there. And you can talk to us. We'd love to hear from you at robojuice.com. That's robojuice.com. Again, thank you so much for listening to the show, and I hope you have a good one.